Hola, ¿qué tal, mi gente? It's Chiquis from Chiquis and Chill Podcast. Welcome to the show. I talk about anything and everything. I did have a miscarriage when I was 19 years old. And that's why I'm a firm believer and an advocate of therapy and counseling. The person that you saw on stage, the person that you saw in interviews, that was my mother off stage.
Acompáñame every Monday on my podcast, Chiquis and Chill, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
People who don't know Bruce have to understand two things. One is he's built like something Michelangelo has carved out of a piece of marble.
True, this is true.
And number two, he's the first person to show you that at every party, at every dinner.
Take a shirt off.
I'm Bruce Bozzi. That was George and Julia. You may not know me yet, but you already know most of my lunch dates by their first names and voices alone. Listen to Table for Two on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy holidays. My podcast on iHeart has brought me together with friends both old and new. Want to know how fashion designer Michael Kors built his iconic American brand? Aren't you curious how rapper Snoop Dogg and I really became good friends? Catch up on the Martha Stewart podcast this holiday season on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We originally released our interview with Lamont McIntyre on September 25th, 2017. Since then, a monumental shift occurred in the dynamic that resulted with Lamont behind bars and his tormentor free. As a detective for Kansas City, Kansas, it's alleged that Roger Golubsky was notorious in the black community for using his authority to coerce women into sexual acts in exchange for leniency, a blind eye, or just for the courtesy of having him not frame them or a member of their family. I'm cautiously optimistic about what appears to be the beginning of justice for Golubsky and the people of Kansas City. Some of you might be aware of this news already, but I'd like to shout it from the rooftops anyway. Golubsky has now been formally charged in several cases, in September 2022 for two counts of sexual assault, same MO as we just mentioned, and then in November 2022, an indictment was unsealed in which Golubsky was alleged to have conspired with a drug kingpin to run a sex trafficking operation that routinely victimized minors. Golubsky allegedly shielded the operation from investigation in exchange for cash and sexual acts from his choice of girls. One of the victims alleged that she was just 16 years old when Golubsky pulled her hair, choked, and raped her. Disgraced Detective Golubsky maintains his innocence, but if these allegations are true, which I'm inclined to believe that they are, I hope he burns in the very real hell in which he put so many innocent and at-risk people. On April 15, 1994, Donnie L. Quinn and Donald Ewing were fatally shot while sitting in a powder blue Cadillac when a man dressed in black pumped four shotgun rounds into the car. One alleged witness claimed to have recognized the shooter as an acquaintance, quote-unquote, Lamont something. Another eyewitness identified 17-year-old Lamont McIntyre from a photo lineup. Both witnesses made positive identifications in court, and despite a total lack of corroborating physical evidence, this case appeared to be as open and shut as they come, resulting in two consecutive life prison terms for Lamont McIntyre. On this episode, we speak with Lamont's appellate attorney, Cheryl Pilot, former FBI agent and police corruption expert Al Jenerick, as well as Lamont himself from behind bars to find out how this seemingly righteous prosecution had actually been corrupted from the very start. This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Today's episode will make your blood boil and it will blow your mind. So settle in, because this is going to be a crazy ride.
Guilty. One word. Sealing Lamont McIntyre's fate.
Lamont McIntyre, age 17 in 1994, has so far been imprisoned for 22 years. 22 years ago, two young men, 21-year-old Danielle Quinn and his 34-year-old cousin, Donald Ewing, were gunned down in a horrible double homicide.
6 hours after the murders, police arrested McIntyre, but never searched his house for evidence.
Moreover, it was a trial in which prosecutors offered no physical evidence tying McIntyre to the crime. No motive, no connection between him and the victims, no weapon, no fingerprints, nor did Kansas City, Kansas Police even request search warrants to find any of that material.
A retired officer who reviewed the case calls the investigation grossly deficient.
Most notable is that the family of the victims for 22 years have steadfastly insisted that he is innocent. Other witnesses, also relatives of the victim, insist that as soon as they saw McIntyre sitting at the defense table, they knew he was not the shooter. They told the prosecutor, but were ignored. One family member has signed an affidavit claiming that under pressure from police and the prosecutor, she lied at McIntyre's trial.
For the first time, a juror is speaking publicly about the case. Greg Lauver says that he now believes that Wyandotte County jury was wrong.
They didn't care about anything. They just had their man.
And it was enough for the 12-person jury. In deliberations, Lauber says he and another juror were holdouts, but it was late in the day and there was mounting pressure from others who wanted a verdict.
Maybe I had an opportunity to, you know, do something good on that jury, but I sure didn't do it. I took a coward's way out.
It is the speedy investigation and prosecution of that crime in this place that a team of exonerators now insist was also the focus of a terrible injustice. Lamont McIntyre, age 17 in 1994, has so far been imprisoned for 22 years, convicted and given two consecutive life sentences for a crime they say he never committed.
Well, I'm just going to say I'm really happy that today, joining us to discuss the insane case of Lamont McIntyre, we have with us Lamont's attorney, Cheryl Pilot, as well as retired FBI Special Agent Al Jenerich. Cheryl and Al, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. We're glad to be here.
Happy to be here.
And we will be hearing later on in the episode from Lamont, who will be calling in from prison in Kansas, where he has been incarcerated for approximately 24 years now, since he was a teenager, for a crime that he did not commit. Now, let's go back to the beginning. On April 15th, 1994, there were two men sitting in a Cadillac in Kansas City, Kansas, when they were approached by a man with a shotgun. These facts are not in dispute, right?
Correct.
And what we know is that four shots were fired into the car, killing the passenger, Danielle Quinn, instantly, and the driver, Donald Ewing, who died later in the hospital. And amazingly, within 6 hours, they managed to find a guy who had nothing to do with the crime, Lamont McIntyre, who was 17 at the time, and he was arrested and charged with two counts of first-degree murder in spite of a total lack of any physical evidence connecting him to the crime. How did this happen, Cheryl? And Al, jump in whenever you want.
Lamont was arrested and prosecuted after police obtained three interviews from eyewitnesses. One of them never testified. But the taped interviews of these eyewitnesses in a very serious crime, obviously, where someone can go to prison for the rest of their life, amounted to a total of 20 taped minutes. And one of the eyewitnesses was only interviewed for 4 minutes. Is that an investigation? What is that?
So, Al, you've done a lot of research, and you were in the FBI for quite a while. Is that right?
I was in the FBI for 25 years. I was a special agent. I specialized in investigating police corruption. I worked in Chicago very successfully, and then in Kansas City, Kansas.
Agent Jenerich was not involved with this murder case at all when it happened. I knew Mr. Jenerich through other cases. And after he retired, a number of years after he retired, actually, and I was working on trying to achieve Lamont's exoneration, I approached him to talk to him about the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department and things that I had uncovered in my investigation. And it was at that point that Al and I started talking about some of the things he had learned while working for the FBI, and they you know, matched up with some of the things I had uncovered in my investigation. And it was because of that that he became a witness in this case that I hope to use at our hearing.
So prior to Lamont's arrest, can we talk about what was happening with this particular cop whose name was Roger Golubsky?
Sometime around 1988 or so, I was able to open an investigation into police corruption in Kansas City, Kansas. And as the investigation went on over time, over many years, we developed maybe somewhere between 12 and 15 police officers who were titled subjects of the investigation. Some of it involved civil rights, like beating people up, stealing their shoes when they were walking down the street because the officer liked the shoes. Or in the case of Golubsky, you know, sexual extortion. But most of it involved corruption involving drugs, mostly cocaine. And in the course of this investigation, just by talking to people, which is what I'm pretty good at, over time, you know, a number of people told us about Golubsky extorting sex from black women. He liked black women. We never developed enough evidence on Golubsky to prosecute him. That's the extent of my knowledge about Golubsky.
I always believed that police were good and the police were on our side and they're there to protect us all. And so I always find these stories, even as long as I've been working on this issue, and I've got 25 years now of experience, but I always find these stories so just depressing and shocking, and it flips everything upside down.
Well, like you, I was very naive until I went to Chicago. And then I saw, you know, police corruption on a massive scale. But then when I got back to Kansas City in 86 and probably got involved in Kansas City, Kansas in 88, you know, I saw the same activity there. It wasn't on the grand scale, you know, that it's conducted in Chicago. It's basically police officers, most of whom are white, picking on minorities, most of whom are black. Some of them are Hispanic. Because when you're a drug dealer, you know, you can't go to the police or the FBI and say, hey, these cops are stealing my drugs. These cops are stealing my drug money. You basically have to suck it up. So that's what they do in Chicago. That's what they do everywhere.
So Lamont, his troubles really began when his mom was in a car with, I guess, was her boyfriend at the time, Cheryl, right? Golubsky approached the car and told her to get out. And threatened her with arrest or arrest of her boyfriend unless she agreed to come down to the police station. And then the problems really began when she refused to become one of his girls, so to speak, right? I mean, obviously she was in a terrible situation where she's very vulnerable, not able to defend herself from a cop who's willing to go to almost any lengths to fulfill his desires. She had a tremendous problem, and she decided that she wanted to maintain her dignity, really, right? And so what seems like happened is that as a consequence, Golubsky decided that he would target and frame her son in something that is so evil that you know, makes me want to quit the human race.
There was an encounter that Lamont's mother had with the detective some years earlier. I mean, it was years actually before the double homicide happened. And at the time of the double homicide, my client was inexplicably dragged into the case. One of the eyewitnesses told the police she thought the shooter looked like a Lamont dating her niece. Police never bothered to find out what Lamont that was. They don't go ask the niece what Lamont that was. They simply put another Lamont, and it's undisputed, an entirely different Lamont, my client, into the case and somehow obtain this identification. What's interesting about the lineup, and I've never seen anything like this before, is three of the five photos were of young male members of the McIntyre family.
You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to say, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. It's one perpetrator. It's not like somebody said there were three brothers that were involved. It's one perpetrator, you know, and then the justice system, we know, has a tendency to chew people up and spit them out when they are poor, particularly if they're minorities and underrepresented. It's not a fair fight is it?
Well, I mean, this whole thing was an impossible battle for Lamont to begin with. I mean, first of all, the investigation itself, I don't think really qualified as a true investigation because so little was done. No evidence of motive was ever uncovered. There was no physical evidence that tied Lamont to the crime. There was not even any evidence that he knew the two victims. Their backgrounds of the two victims and who might have a motive to harm them, that was never investigated. There was an eyewitness directly across the street who was never interviewed, whose mother said, you know, she knows who the suspect is. I mean, the failures and lapses and irregularities in this case just go on and on. I mean, other than the 20 minutes of taped interviews from the eyewitnesses, there was very little else. And the only evidence at trial against Lamont were two eyewitnesses. One of them has admitted that she lied, that she was coerced. The other eyewitness seems, frankly, very perplexed by her testimony, and it's very clear that it's an eyewitness misidentification based on manipulation.
And we know also that had this trial taken place 20 years later or so, with everything that's known now about the unreliability of eyewitness identification, there's a very good chance that that would have been discredited because there was no other evidence connecting him to the crime.
You take a person who's traumatized, who has just witnessed a really horrific event, and they can be pretty easy to pressure or manipulate. And in fact, this witness provided in a taped statement my client's last name, a man she did not know and had never heard of, which raises the very interesting question of who gave her the name? It was undisputed at trial that she did not know my client, yet the fact that there was an original tape statement where she provided his name never came out. That was never admitted at trial. She also stated wrongly that my client was the Lamont who had dated her niece at trial. Undisputed that that was not true. It was an entirely different Lamont who was, in fact, identified by his name to the jury, an entirely different person. So, I mean, the whole thing is troubling beginning to end, really a perfect storm of chaos and horror and misconduct, things being done improperly.
So you have this cop and this department that is so corrupt isn't even the right word, but that's engaged in so many illegal activities. And isn't it ironic and tragic that Lamont is in prison living in hell after 24 years, and this cop who was, from what I've read, raping people, robbing people, dealing drugs, protecting drug dealers, he's out. How is that? I mean, and that must not sit well with you, with your whole background either.
What I'm really hoping for, what our entire team is hoping for, and what we have sought for a long time, is a very full investigation into the activities of this detective. There needs to be an investigation by people who have the power to follow all the leads, develop information, compel the testimony of witnesses, and obtain other evidence.
Al, let me turn to you for a second, because we have not had somebody with your background and experience on the show before. And I would venture to say that you had a very, very difficult and dangerous job, right? I mean, investigating cops, particularly when you're investigating cops who've got a lot to hide, makes you a very unpopular person, I would think. So looking back on it, how did this manage to go on for so long without somebody coming along and saying, you know, besides you, Hey, we're not going to tolerate this.
They don't give a shit. At the time we were doing these investigations, the police chief of Kansas City, Kansas, a guy named Tom Daley, he had previously been indicted by the Federal Strike Force for extorting money at a whorehouses along the Kaw River in Kansas. He was doing that allegedly when he was a captain. He was acquitted because it was a real weak case. But after being acquitted for extortion, the city wound up eventually making him the chief. Is that the actions, you know, of a responsible city administration or a police department? So you have the chief over there, Tom Daley, who had previously been indicted by the feds. He despised the federal government. He hated the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, and he's the chief. He was part of it.
So you have this guy, Golubsky, who in that scenario is operating basically with impunity, right? Because he knows his chief doesn't give a shit. And with the chief having literally, well, from what it sounds like, gotten away with that particular pattern of activity, as well as, I'm sure, other things that he was doing, the people underneath him are probably thinking, hey, this is great. No one's going to touch us.
And they're right.
And nobody did. So how frustrating was that for you? There you are, really fighting an unwinnable war, right? You're there trying to protect the public from the police force with a chief of police who not only doesn't give a fuck, but doesn't want that. He wants you. He probably wants you to fuck out of his hair so he can just, you know, run the streets how he wants to.
Right. When I started working over there, you had a person, you know, some guy. I knew a lot of people in the county jail. And they would say, so-and-so confronted me and stole my money, stole my drugs. You go, what's the cop's name? I don't know his name. You know, what's he look like? Well, you know, he's some white guy. Well, you go to the police did not have photographs of their police officers. So if a victim came in there alleging that so-and-so officer robbed from me, extorted me, they didn't even have photographs to show people so they could identify who the police officer was.
So good luck.
You know, through the U.S. Attorney's Office, through Julie Robinson, who was a prosecutor at the time, we subpoenaed photographs of every sworn officer in the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department, and there was hell to pay for that. I was almost removed from the investigation because of that.
I think one of the problems is that other law enforcement officers don't want to investigate law enforcement. And as a general rule, I think they find it distasteful, something they would rather avoid. And there is a tendency to minimize misconduct. I found that really pretty shocking.
Not in light of everything else we're talking about, but I could see how you would. And it really gets easier and easier to see how these wrongful convictions are so common. I mean, here we have an interesting situation, right? We're talking to Al, who's in there with his badge, working for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and basically being told, go fuck himself. So what chance does a 17-year-old black kid from the poorer side of town, what chance does he have against this blue wall, this blue monster that was out to get him? He had no chance. So now, fast forward to 24 years later, Lamont sits in a prison studying, reading, by all accounts, a model prisoner, somebody who maintains a positive outlook in spite of this, you know, what can only be described as the worst fate that can befall an individual, to be incarcerated for something he didn't do for the rest of your life. But now we have hope, right? I mean, he has hope, thanks to you and the years of work that you've done on this case, and Al and other brave people who have devoted their time and, in some cases, probably even risk their own personal safety to try to get justice in this case. What does it look like now? What happens next? Tell us what's going on.
We have a evidentiary hearing coming up in October, and we intend to present somewhere between 40 and 50 witnesses who provide very powerful testimony on various aspects of the case. There was almost nothing really to support the conviction to begin with, nothing other than the testimony of the two eyewitnesses. And I believe that has been thoroughly shredded at this point through recantations and admissions and the result of other investigation. And we are also focusing on the very troubling misconduct in the case. It is intimately connected to how the investigation was conducted. And we're going to bring all that out and show how we believe this went wrong. And we very much hope to be successful.
What's the date of the hearing?
October 12th.
October 12th. And is this in a federal court?
We are in Wyandotte County District Court, which is a state court. My client is litigating what's called a successive petition under 60-1507, and you have essentially a procedural barrier to get over before you can get back into court. But we do have this evidentiary hearing scheduled that we are very, very excited about. One of the most compelling things about the case, we haven't mentioned this yet, is that the families of both victims have always known my client is innocent and are very much squarely supporting the quest to free him. They know that they did not get justice. Their families did not get justice.
And that, Cheryl, in your experience, that's not a common thing, right? I mean, most of the cases I've seen, even in the face of what could be overwhelming evidence to the contrary, the victim's family sometimes stick with what they've been told all along because they just can't, they can't even process the idea that they may have been lied to and that the wrong person may have been serving time for the murder of their loved one. So in this case, this is a very unusual scenario, isn't it?
It is. And one of the eyewitnesses is related to both of the victims. And she, her family, and the family of the second victim, to whom she's a bit more distantly related, have always told me that they have known from the beginning that the authorities got the wrong man. They have always known this. They've made periodic efforts to correct this, to address this, to try and get some justice, all without success.
And if there wasn't already enough to chew on, this is the part that really just sets me off. His court-appointed attorney, Gary Long, was on supervised probation at the time of the trial for failing to diligently handle three prior cases. He was suspended from the bar a couple years later for failure to adequately handle a separate criminal case, and he was disbarred in 1998. How is it even possible that in a life or death situation that you take somebody and you say, you know what, we're going to give you a lawyer who's already messed up three times.
Well, when I said nobody gives a shit, do you understand what I mean? Do you know that you know that Tara Moorhead, do you know she's now a federal prosecutor?
Yeah, so Tara Moorhead was the prosecutor in this case, obviously didn't see anything wrong with her prosecuting a case in which a young man's life was at stake in front of a judge with whom she had carried on an affair a few years earlier. I think most reasonable people would agree that one or the other should have been recused from this particular scenario, because even if they were saints, and obviously they weren't, because she's also the same woman, from what I've read, who threatened a witness who tried to come forward with the truth with losing custody of her own children. But yeah, so now she's moved up the ladder. Seems like all the bad guys have won here. Al, what the fuck?
Well, I think Tara Moorhead's currently married to a police officer. I think there's some other prosecutors over in the federal U.S. Attorney's Office that are married to other police officers. So you're not going to expect them to investigate police corruption, are you?
Well, I guess that would make it tricky, wouldn't it?
They're not going to do it, and they don't.
I mean, there's so much that could be investigated, that ought to be investigated. And, you know, I should also point out that sexual misconduct among police officers is not unusual in some departments. When you have poor and vulnerable people encounter folks with ultimate authority over them, ultimate authority in that particular moment, you know, those things can happen all too easily. And they do. And they happen frequently.
You know, when I was an agent, I'm about 6'4". I had a gun, a badge, and a radio and everything. At nighttime, when I was on my way home or on the weekends, I would not drive through Kansas City, Kansas, unless I was accompanied by another FBI agent.
So because you thought they might have run you off the road or something else?
They could do anything. They could pull me over and not saying they don't know who I was, and they could say I pulled a gun and they could shoot me. So I have all that power and authority. What does some little black kid on the street have?
I hope that in exposing the story of Lamont and some of the things that you shared, Al, that people, you know, get their backs up and get angry and get involved. These are just people. They're just regular people. And they're being so terribly abused and victimized by people who are supposed to protect them. I don't, it makes me sick.
I was just saying that the fear and the terror that some of the citizens experience cannot be overstated. I mean, you have someone with a badge with ultimate and really, as I said, in that moment, unchecked authority. There's enormous fear of the police and enormous, sometimes unmovable, resistance to getting involved in anything that has to do with the criminal justice system. I've spent some years, honestly, just earning the trust of some people in the community so that they will sit down and speak with me so that we can investigate the case. Nobody wants anything to do with a case. You say courthouse, people walk the other way. They don't want anything to do with that. And ultimately, we have been successful in securing some very good witnesses because they did want to help someone they viewed as innocent. And, you know, I should point out here that all of the street talk we have ever heard in the community is that Lamont is innocent, the guy who got wrongfully convicted. It's like everyone knows, the whole community knows, the victims' families know, everyone knows Lamont did not do this. Everyone knows.
America is obsessed with true crime stories. Everywhere you go, you hear people talking about their favorite true crime podcasts. And all that excitement has made you a little crime curious. But with so many true crime podcasts to choose from, the real mystery is, where do you start? iHeart Podcasts has cracked the case. They created iHeart True Crime Plus, your source for the best true crime podcasts all in one channel. iHeart True Crime Plus brings you the best of true crime with shows that cover everything from unsolved murders and missing persons to heists, organized crime, and everything in between. So you're sure to find something you'll want to binge and share. And as an iHeart True Crime Plus subscriber, you'll also enjoy ad-free listening, early access to select episodes, and exclusive never-before-heard bonus content. Feed your true crime obsession. Subscribe to iHeart True Crime Plus today, exclusively on Apple Podcasts.
Happy holidays. My podcast on iHeart has brought me together with friends both old and new. Want to know how fashion designer Michael Kors built his iconic American brand? Or how the legendary impresario Clive Davis found his way into the music industry? Aren't you curious how rapper Snoop Dogg and I really became good friends? All the answers to these questions and more are on the Martha Stewart podcast. Tune in every week when I talk to interesting and inspiring individuals. I've interviewed entrepreneurs, artisans, baseball players, and fashion greats, comedians, designers, photographers, and restaurateurs, architects, plant experts, farming experts, and hospitality experts. Catch up on the Martha Stewart podcast this holiday season on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
People who don't know Bruce have to understand two things. One is he's built like something Michelangelo has carved out of a piece of marble.
True, this is true.
And number two, he's the first person to show you that at every party, at every dinner.
Maybe take a shirt off.
Shirt comes off like before dessert.
I'm Bruce Bozzi. You may not know me yet, but you already know most of my lunch dates by their first names and voices alone. That was George and Julia. But believe it or not, my podcast guests see me as more than just a piece of meat. Like my thoughtful friend, Scarlett.
Bruce Bozzi, I love you so much, and I love meeting minds with you.
What we do on my new podcast, Table for Two, is what everyone does when they're at lunch with an old friend. We tell stories. We definitely gossip.
James Corden wound up kind of ripping off your set. There you go.
And we always go deep. Listen to Table for Two on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You have a prepaid call from
Lamont,
an inmate at Kansas Department of Corrections, Lansing Correctional Facility. To accept this call, press or say 5. To refuse, this call will be recorded and subject to monitoring at any time. You may begin speaking now.
Lamont, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Lamont, I want to go back to the beginning, when you grew up, and how this all started. I've seen photos of you with your family. It looked like you had not an easy, but a happy childhood. Is that fair?
Yeah, I did.
Can you just describe what it was like? I've heard you talk about Christmas and stuff.
We was tight-knit, you know. It was like my mother was just the only parent in the house, and we was close, me and my siblings, and we did everything together. We stayed in one house, you know, we took care of each other. So growing up for me was, family was a big thing. We didn't really fight about a lot of stuff, you know. It was me and my three brothers and my sister, my older sister. My mother worked a lot, so my sister kind of watched after us a little bit. Some other family members, I used to go to my family members' house, my uncles, and be around them. My mother was at work. I kind of still stayed around family outside my home, so real family-oriented.
And where you grew up, you had no idea at this time that the police force was really as corrupt as anyone could possibly imagine until this terrible incident occurred. And I want to go back to that. What happened? You were a 17-year-old kid going along with your life, trying to make it in a difficult place. And then one day, out of the blue, you get arrested and don't even know what's going on? Or what happened?
That's exactly what happened. It was a typical day. It was like a Friday, typical day. I was enrolled in a Downey College program where it's an alternative school where they would help you get your high school diploma. And then they'd get you in college. So it was like a little degree program I was a part of. And it was just a Friday. I get a phone call. And the police is over my grandmother's house looking for me. Call my mother. We go to the police station, and they start talking about two murders. And I had no answers for them because I didn't know what they were saying or what they were talking about. So from that moment, I was arrested, charged, and eventually convicted of two murders that I had nothing to do with and knew nothing about.
And we know now that they were deliberately targeting you because of this particular police officer who was up to all kinds of criminal activity himself. And that's the irony of this, is that he belongs in jail. And I'm hoping that by the end of this, that's exactly what's going to happen. But the idea that this system, this so-called justice system, had made a decision that you were going to be their guy. There was this double murder, right? Two guys sitting in a car. They were involved in drug activity. They were dealers. We now know also that one of them had been beaten by the guys he was working for in the drug business, right? He was working as a doorman in a crack den. And he had feared for his life. And in fact, he had good reason to, because I guess he had, from what I've learned, he had been stealing from them. So they had every reason to know that this was a drug hit. And you weren't involved in that gang or that business. Did you know these guys?
Nah, I didn't know the witnesses. I didn't know the victims. And I wasn't connected to it at all. That's why it's so hard for me to understand how something like that could happen. And I was forward about everything. I didn't try to hide nothing because I knew that what they was talking about at that time, I had nothing to do with it, and I wasn't involved. I don't know what the police officer's motive was to plan it on me, or I still don't know to this day what happened.
Well, it does seem like now with everything we've learned that the officer involved, the first one who arrived on the scene, was an officer named Golubsky. It's a white guy who had a proclivity for women of color. And when he didn't get his way, he would exact revenge. And so what it seems like is that in this particular case, he targeted you because your mom wasn't having any part of that. And that's what makes this particularly sinister and sick. You end up going to trial. And I find it interesting, among all the other things in your case, that they offered you a plea bargain, right? And you didn't take it.
Yeah, I wasn't interested in a plea bargain. I can't understand how I was sitting in that situation. And I didn't know nothing about the crime itself. So a plea bargain was far from my mind. I wasn't thinking about a plea bargain.
And why I find that, and why I brought that up, Lamont, and I've seen the mugshot picture of you, and it really hurt my heart because I could see in your face just how confused you were and scared of a situation that you couldn't possibly imagine was happening at that time. I also would think that if you were guilty and they're offering you a deal, and you know your chances of winning in the court are going to be low because they have all these cops and everybody else that's going to testify against you. You would have taken the plea bargain. Anybody with a right mind would take a plea bargain. You're not crazy, are you?
No, I'm not.
Right. You don't sound crazy at all. So in a situation like this, I mean, we have in this country over 90% of cases end up in plea bargains. So had you been guilty, that would have been a very logical thing to do. But as an innocent person and probably somebody who's still trusted in the system, you went forward with your right to a trial. And you were represented by a guy who they knew, your court-appointed lawyer, they knew this guy was incompetent because he had already been disciplined for three previous cases that he had completely botched. It almost sounds like they did it on purpose. They assigned a guy who didn't go interview witnesses, who didn't do anything he was supposed to do. And what was that like? Were you aware at that time that this guy wasn't, I mean, I don't even know if he was really on your side, but as you're watching these proceedings, what were you thinking?
He presented himself like a lawyer. He presented himself like a person that's there on my behalf to take care of this business. And he seemed real professional at first. So I didn't know what to expect because I'd never been in that situation before anyway. So his first impression was a good impression because I didn't know what a lawyer was supposed to do. I was so ignorant to the law and how things work. I just believed in the justice system at that time. I really did. I thought there was no possible way, being an innocent person or a person that has nothing to do with that crime, that I would be found guilty. So I didn't really pay too much attention to the credibility of this lawyer. It just didn't dawn on me that I would be found guilty of the crime that I had nothing to do with. So I didn't really think about it in those terms. I was just thinking, you can give me any lawyer, anybody from anywhere, and it'd be okay because once they realize they had the wrong person, it'd get ironed out in trial. That's what I was thinking. But I didn't think that people would get on the stand and lie and they was going to fabricate, and I didn't think that was going to happen. I had no idea that they had already made up in their mind that I was going to be the scapegoat for this particular crime. So that was me being ignorant of the law and how things worked in the justice system. I believed in the justice system at that time. I really did.
I think all of us do when we're kids, especially brought up in a good home like you were. You're brought up to believe that people are good and that the system is going to work for you. And then you had a lawyer who, had he been competent, I still think would have won your case in spite of all this because of the simple fact that it was an easy case. The witnesses were not credible at all. We now know that they also withheld exculpatory evidence. So you really didn't have a fair chance, especially not with a lawyer who was incompetent. And ultimately, let's not forget that this particular lawyer was disbarred not too long after your trial. And again, for the listeners out there, think about that. This is a guy who had been disciplined in numerous cases prior to Lamont's, and then ultimately gets disbarred when the extent of his gross incompetence is brought to the Supreme Court of Kansas, the attention of the Supreme Court, and then he voluntarily gave up his license to practice law. And that wasn't the end of the nightmare. We now know, too, that your appellate lawyer was disbarred. I mean, you can't even make this stuff up. So what happened? Like, now you're in the courtroom. The jury goes out. The arguments have been made. You saw these witnesses get up and lie. You saw these police officers get up and lie. Your defense made whatever arguments they made. Did you believe that they would come back and declare you innocent?
I did. Every fiber of my being, I did. I just didn't know that this is how the system worked. They found me guilty based on false evidence or the kind of evidence that was presented by a certain district attorney. They heard stuff about me that wasn't even about Lamont McIntyre. That she just kind of made stuff up, like told a story, and the jury believed it. But at the time, before they came back with a guilty verdict, I still didn't think I'd be found guilty because the whole time I'm sitting there and the whole time I'm going through the process of getting to trial, I still had no knowledge of the actual crime. So I'm thinking, with my young mind, being naive, that there's no way a jury can find me guilty when I'm really not guilty, when I had nothing to do with it. I'm not tied to it at all. The witnesses, the victims, I'm not tied to it. I wasn't in the area when it happened. When they came in, I noticed that no jury, no one looked me in my face. No one looked up. Everyone came in looking down at the floor. So I kind of had an eerie feeling, but I still had hope that it would work out in the right way. So when they read the verdict and they said guilty, it's like I seen my whole life flash before me. And for that moment, I froze, and I was sitting there, and I stood up, and I just remember saying something. I was screaming something, you know, to the effect of, I'm not guilty, and you got the wrong person, or whatever. And I felt someone hold me or grab me from behind, and I was in shock. So I didn't really, I was like a lost moment. But I turned around, and I see my mother holding me, screaming, crying, like, don't take my baby away from me, don't take my baby. And I'm looking at her, and I realized that this is a serious situation. Now I'm, but it still didn't feel real. It was my life and my situation, but it didn't feel like my life or my situation. I felt like I was outside of myself looking at this event happen. I couldn't stop it. So I was in shock. And that shock lasted for a few years after that. I was in shock.
So now, Lamont, now you're convicted of a double murder and sentenced to life in prison. Where did they take you to?
The process is like from the time you get convicted, you stay in the county for about 2 months, then you go to sentencing. Now, I was sentenced in Wyandotte County. They gave me 2 life sentences to run consecutive. Then after that, they sent me to a processing center, which we call RDU, where they send you to determine what classification you would be, what custody you would be in. I was considered max custody. So from there, they sent me to prison. I was in Hutch. That's a prison in Kansas. They call it Gladiator School. One of those tough prisons, you know, where people, you know, it's a prison. It's like the worst idea you have of prison is that more. It's dark, it's negative, it's tension filled, it's hopeless, it's a world in its own.
Happy holidays. My podcast on iHeart has brought me together with friends both old and new. Want to know how fashion designer Michael Kors built his iconic American brand? Or how the legendary impresario Clive Davis found his way into the music industry? Aren't you curious how rapper Snoop Dogg and I really became good friends? All the answers to these questions and more are on the Martha Stewart podcast. Tune in every week when I talk to interesting and inspiring individuals. I've interviewed entrepreneurs, artisans, baseball players, and fashion greats, comedians, designers, photographers, and restaurateurs, architects, plant experts, farming experts, and hospitality experts. Catch up on the Martha Stewart podcast this holiday season on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
People who don't know Bruce have to understand 2 things. One is he's built like something Michelangelo has carved out of a piece of marble.
True. This is true.
And 2, he's the first person to show you that at every party, at every dinner.
Maybe take a shirt off.
Shirt comes off like before dessert.
I'm Bruce Bozzi. You may not know me yet, but you already know most of my lunch dates by their first names and voices alone. That was George and Julia. But believe it or not, my podcast guests see me as more than just a piece of meat. Like my thoughtful friend, Scarlett.
Bruce Bozzi, I love you so much, and I love meeting minds with you.
What we do on my new podcast, Table for Two, is what everyone does when they're at lunch with an old friend. We tell stories. We definitely gossip.
James Corden wound up kind of ripping off your set.
There you go.
And we always go deep. Listen to Table for Two on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tyler Florence.
And I'm Wells Adams. We're the hosts of the new podcast, Two Dudes in a Kitchen. You might be asking yourself, why do these guys have a podcast?
Because we love food.
Yep.
You and I have known each other for a while. We got a chance to cook together on television on Food Network back in the day. And I got to tell you, there's no two better guys that are more equipped to take you guys on a journey through the kitchen. It's all about great recipes. It's all about connecting with fantastic techniques and having a great time while you're doing it. This is a podcast for you to call into, give us your feedback, and we're here to answer your questions, kind of get those kitchen burners fired up.
I got a lot of questions just because I'm not nearly as good of a chef as you are, so I'm going to be asking you a lot of questions, and you guys out there can ask them as well. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to learn a lot, and you know what? Most importantly, we're going to eat good.
We're going to eat good, man. Eat good in the neighborhood, man. We're here for you.
Listen to Two Dudes in a Kitchen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thank you. As a 17-year-old, did you have plans? Did you have a career in mind? What was the outlook for the future? Were you still just trying to figure it out?
Yeah, it was things I wanted to do. It was just, I was misguided a lot, and I was just in a place where everybody around me was either dying or going to jail, or I was just in the kind of environment that didn't produce a lot of hope, or I didn't have a lot of people to look up to or emulate, nothing like that, but I did enjoy taking care of my family, so my life was just basically about trying to take care of my family the best way I knew how, or to look out for my loved ones, or, you know, I had skills and things I could do, like I was a barber, I was cutting hair since I was 12, or, you know, I was a comedian, you know, I had these, in the back of my mind, I wanted to be a comedian, and I had things I wanted to do, I just didn't know how to get to where I wanted to be, but I still didn't think that my life would consist of being in prison or going to jail or being in this kind of situation.
What is a typical day like for you on the inside? How do you get through it? What's the schedule?
Typical day is readjusting. It's like from one day to the next, it's finding a way to get by. For one day, learn something from my days, and then I just try to, it just sucks, I gotta repeat it. Like, if I have a bad day or I'm frustrated for one day, I go to sleep, wake up to repeat this day again. So I try to find the best I can or get the best I can out of a day, because waking up to repeat it is the anxiety. That's where all that, the worst stuff is, knowing that for the last 23 years and 200 something months and 1,100 weeks and 8,000 days, it's the same thing. It never changes. So I devote my time to reading and studying and write. I write music, I write poetry. I try to keep my mind free as possible. I try to stay out of prison mentally. I'm not into prison politics. I'm not in prison mentally, but I'm here. I have to be in my body here, but I try to keep my mind as far from this place as I can. So it's just a bunch of moments of readjusting every day. Like, and I have a lot of love, people that love me and care about me, so I focus on that. But it's bad. It used to be a lot worse than it is now. I'm starting to see, I'm coming alive now, because I can see a light at the end of this dark tunnel I've been in for so long. So I'm better now, but yeah, it wasn't so good before. It's better now, but it was always sad to wake up and have to repeat this same cycle over and over again. That stuff is enough to drive a person crazy. There's a lot of moments where I felt like, what's the point? You know, to keep going, to wake up every day, to have to deal with the exact same nightmare you're trying to escape from the night before. But I had my mother, like, she never gave up on me from day one. Like, when the worst moments of my life, you know, I felt like I just couldn't do it no more. I felt like I couldn't take another step. She would show up, and she would grab me and hold me and look me in my face and tell me, this is not my life. I'm passing through. This is not my destination. And so I had a lot of support from my family, and I gave my life to God, and I pray a lot, I meditate a lot. So initially I was kind of in this dark place where I was just so hurt and sad and depressed. And so people kept coming to my life that was like beacons of light and hope for me. And I thank God for all those people who came into my life and supported me and made sure that I always had something to look forward to. Because this is a dark place, it's a dark situation where if you don't have enough support, for me it was just support. I had family support, and then years later, Cheryl and Centurion Ministries and Innocent Projects, they kind of started coming into my life, and they breathed life into me. It's like a second wind, and I'm grateful for those people, everybody who supported me, and everybody who put forth effort and go out every day and do something to help me get my life back. I'm forever grateful for those people.
If you even allow yourself, if you allow your mind to go there, what are you dreaming about when you get out? Because I'm convinced you are going to come home, and I'm going to be there fighting right alongside with everybody else. What's the first thing you want to do, and then how do you see the future?
The first thing I'm going to do is eat something. That's what I fantasize about mostly. I want to eat something, and then from there, I want to have some type of impact or effect on young people making poor decisions that would eventually land them in a situation like this. You know, so I want to just raise any kind of awareness I can about decision making, because, you know, had I been taught how to make better decisions for myself, I think even though I was ignorant to the law and this is something that had nothing to do with me and all that, I still could have been making better decisions for myself before this stuff even came about. So I just want to be able to be there for young people as much as I can so I can help them understand that even though you don't do something wrong, even though you don't commit a crime, you still got to be accountable and you still got to be mindful of the fact that you're out there floating around and you can easily be put in a situation like that if you're not being productive and doing something that's productive out there in life. So I just want to be able to reach the young people as much as I can. And now that I said to be young, just anybody, I just want to be able to share my experience and hopefully it'll help out in any kind of way.
I'm sure that you will do that and that you're going to have a very positive impact on a lot of people because you have a very rare combination of intelligence and a manner that is so positive and strong but still gentle that I believe that you'll be able to affect a lot of young people, and I'm looking forward to watching you do that. There's one other thing I wanted to raise. I'm always amazed when I speak to someone in your situation, and especially so with you, that you don't seem to be bitter after everything that's happened. And I know you talked about your faith and family and the strength that you get from them, but how is it possible that someone can go through this most unimaginable nightmare, still be in it, and yet be as positive and strong as you are now?
Well, I had my moments with anger, but it was always like taking poison, hoping someone else died from it. I was the only one affected by me being angry. No one else seemed to notice or pay attention to me being angry, so that was just a learning experience. Like, being angry doesn't help me, so I just wanted to help myself because I always knew I wasn't going to be here forever. I knew that eventually the truth would surface and I would have a life outside of these walls. So I devoted a lot of time and energy towards helping myself, not hurting myself. So being angry was something that was a hindrance to me, not a benefit. So I try to stay positive because this place is, you got to keep up with yourself and take care of yourself. And anger and stress and all those things is just shorten your lifespan, and I got life to live, so I choose to be positive. I choose to not be angry and allow anger to kill me. I don't want to die in this place, and I don't want to have a short life, so I stick firm to what I believe in. I believe in my faith, and I believe in meditation, I believe in exercise, I believe in taking care of my mind, body, and soul, and that's what I devote my time to.
Wow. All I can do is tell you that you have all my respect and support. And I have a saying, Lamont, you know, I've seen too many miracles to stop believing in miracles. So I'm excited to watch you be the next one or one of the next ones. And we'll never stop fighting for you and for other people in your situation. I'm looking forward to a positive outcome and to getting to know you on the outside. Lamont, I'm just going to turn it over to you and say, it's your microphone. What do you want to share with the audience?
Well, these kind of cases happen more than they should, you know, so it's like I always see on TV or Dayline 2020, you see an innocent man so many years in prison, then he get exonerated. And you see this happen time and time again. But what you never, ever see or ever hear about is how much that stuff impacted or affected the families of those people. Like, I had a close-knit family. We was close, and it was a thing. This is not just like me being affected by an event that happened in my life. It hurts me to see how much it affected not only me, but my family. And it's difficult because if a man has to go through a certain thing by himself, that's his life. That's his path in life. He got to go through that. I had to do what I had to do no matter what. But when you see somebody you care about being affected by what you had to do or what you had to endure, It's a different kind of feeling, and it's like people don't really pay attention to that or know about that. Like when district attorneys are being dishonest when they're trying to get convictions and all that, I don't think they take that into consideration, how many people they are affecting by just not going by the law, just not being truthful about certain things. It's not just me. Whatever issue, personal issue they may have had about with me, my family is affected by that. My brother's kids, when all this happened, and they feel like they lost a mother because my mother devoted so much time to trying to get me back out of the system that they felt like they was neglected, so they was affected by that. My older sister was affected. My brother was affected. I mean, everybody was affected.
1 minute remaining.
And when you try to hold on to something good, even when you try to get something good in this kind of situation, it's still nothing good come from it. It's just always bad. It's always negative. It's always a challenge. It's always hurdles. It's always something. But for the person that's in the middle of it, that's just my experience. But on the outside of it, that's something people don't ever get a chance to see. That's just a harsh reality for a person to live based on someone else being incompetent. When all this stuff basically could have been avoided by someone just doing their job or the job people was employed them to do. You know? So I think people should understand that and know that there's a lot of people to be affected by something like that. I think a lot of attention should be brought to this moment and this kind of situation so a lot of people can, if you ever find another person in that situation, they can be more mindful of that. Try to help in a different kind of way if they could, because it's not just about me. It's about everybody who cares about me, too.
On October 13th, 2017, Wyandotte County District Attorney Mark Dupree moved to vacate the conviction and dismissed all charges against Lamont McIntyre. Hours later, Lamont walked free for the first time in over 23 long, miserable years. He called me from the courthouse steps. It was one of the best calls I've ever gotten. And in that call, he said he thanked me. And he said that the exposure that his case had gotten from being on this podcast had helped. And even if it was a tiny bit, it had helped to lead to his exoneration. It was a really extraordinary feeling, and I'm excited to share that. Lamont has since won a $1.5 million judgment for his wrongful conviction, and he and his mother are currently suing Roger Golubsky for all the damage he did to their lives and their family. After a 30-year reign of terror in the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department, disgraced officer Roger Golubsky went to work in Edwardsville, Kansas in 2010. He has yet to face justice, and he retired in 2016. Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all three platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
Hola, ¿qué tal, mi gente? It's Chiquis from Chiquis and Chill Podcast. Welcome to the show. I talk about anything and everything. I did have a miscarriage when I was 19 years old. And that's why I'm a firm believer and an advocate of therapy and counseling. The person that you saw on stage, the person that you saw in interviews, that was my mother off stage. Acompáñame every Monday on my podcast, Chiquis and Chill, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
People who don't know Bruce have to understand two things. One is he's built like something Michelangelo has carved out of a piece of marble.
Truth, this is true.
And number two, he's the first person to show you that at every party, at every dinner.
Maybe take a shirt off.
I'm Bruce Bozzi. That was George and Julia. You may not know me yet, but you already know most of my lunch dates by their first names and voices alone. Listen to Table for Two on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy Holidays, my podcast on iHeart has brought me together with friends both old and new. Want to know how fashion designer Michael Kors built his iconic American brand? Aren't you curious how rapper Snoop Dogg and I really became good friends? Catch up on the Martha Stewart podcast this holiday season on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.